Good morning, everybody. When we think of nanophysics as being defined by the length scale, then you'd be inclined to think that nanophysics is mesoscopic physics, only smaller. But this is a mistake, because as we get to smaller length scales, all kinds of details of the system become important. The chemistry, the composition. Still, it's a natural step in our drive to understand and control smaller systems. And in this step, we make use of all that we have learned from mesoscopic physics. Today, I want to take you to the smallest length scale, a single atom, and study its conductance properties. And I will show you that we have used borrowed concepts from mesoscopic physics in understanding and analyzing this problem. And I want to concentrate today on a single aspect of these, that is conductance fluctuations. It's work that has been done mostly by Bas Ludov already some time ago, and I have not often talked about it, but I hope to convince you that there is really interesting physics in it. Okay, so let me first show the people who have been involved in this work. There is in Leiden a list of PhD students over the years, but as I said, the most important for today is Bas Ludov. And in this work, we have collaborated at various stages with the group in Saclay, Michel Devoret, Daniel Esteve, and Christian Urbina. But we have had continuous collaborations on various aspects of the problem with the group in Madrid and with Elke Scheer, who is now in Constance. So when we say we study atomic size systems, then I have to explain you how we make these, explain you how we make these. And essentially, you could use an STM and bring a tip of an STM into contact with the surface, just pull back until you have a contact of a single atom. And many people use such techniques. We have introduced some years ago what we call the mechanically controllable break junction technique, and it has great advantages in this respect. What we do is we start from a contact which we make by just having a macroscopic wire in which we cut a notch in the center, and we mount the wire on a bending beam, which is then mounted in a three-point bending configuration. Then this whole thing goes into a vacuum pot and is cooled down to low temperatures. And then once it's cooled at 4 Kelvin, we drive this axis from above, and so that when we do that, the thing comes forward and bends the beam here, so that it makes stress on this narrowest part, which then breaks. Okay, we follow the conductance, the resistance of that contact, until we see that it's broken. By that, this is just a macroscopic wire, so we have made a macroscopic fracture surface there. But the great advantage is that we have exposed clean surfaces, which remain clean because of the cryogenic environment that we sit in. All gases have frozen out. It's much better than UHV. And then we can relax the stress and relax the bending and use this piezo element here to control the bending and adjust the contact of a single atom. When you do that, then here I show an example for gold. You can bring the contact, the two surfaces together, pull out, and repeat that many times. And you see that you find conductance curves that look like this. So on the horizontal scale is the piezo voltage, that's the voltage on the piezo element that controls the elongation, and I will refer to that as a distance scale. And then we have conductance, and what we see is that the conductance drops in steps, which is just due to the atomic structure of the contact. And since we do not control this atomic structure, it's not surprising to see that each curve looks different. Nevertheless, there are certain reproducible features, and as you see, the last plateau that we find for gold before it breaks is nicely reproducible at 1 times 2e square over h. So it's very clear that we have to describe this system by quantum mechanics. So what do? We think of it as a scattering problem. Our contact is something that that we do not know, but we can think of as incoming waves being partially scattered at the contact and partially transmitted. So then we know how to do that. We set up a vector of incoming waves, we set up a vector of outgoing waves, and we connect these by a matrix of transmission amplitudes. And then Landauer tells us that the conductance is given by this expression here. Okay? Now, why do I tell you this? Because for all of you, this is very familiar. The important step now is that we can always write this as 2e square over h times the sum of the transmission probabilities. That means whatever the structure of this contact is, we can diagonalize this matrix and find the diagonal elements. And the number of these diagonal elements is only determined by the smallest size, the number of diagonal elements is determined by the number of waves that we take into account, but the number of non-zero diagonal elements is determined by the narrowest part of the contact. And so for a single atom, it's determined by the properties of that single atom. So what we will try to do is understand how we can determine the transmission probabilities for a single atom. And now that would be a too long story for the time that I'm allowed to speak. So I will give you the summary and then show how conductance fluctuations can give us evidence for this. And the story is as follows. If we take monovalent metals like gold, which have a single s-type orbital, then the number of conductance modes that you have through that contact of a single atom is 1. We can roughly think of the number of channels that we have available through a single atom as the number of valence orbitals. And the conductance, if we make experiment or we do a calculation like was done in the group of Levi-Yati and Martin Rodero in Madrid, tight binding calculations and other type of local density type calculations like have been done in many other groups, you find a conductance which is very close to 1. However, if you go to SP metals like aluminium and lead, you get 3 channels, 3 p orbitals, 1 s orbital, and an antisymmetric combination of PZ and S drops out. It appears to be very a poor conductor. So essentially we have 3 then. And the total conductance then depends on the coupling of that atom to the surrounding, but is for aluminium in the range of 1.8 to 1.2, and for lead is higher. Lead has 1 valence electron more. D metals like niobium, we have, for the same reason as we have 3 here, we have 5 here, 5 D orbitals, 1 S, and 1 drops out. And the total conductance appears to be in this range. Okay. Now, various techniques have been used to verify this. Especially important was the subgap structure analysis that was introduced by Elke Scheer and co-workers when she was working in Saclay. And we verified this with shot noise. But as I said today, I want to talk about conductance fluctuations. Now, conductance fluctuations we know mostly as universal conductance fluctuations. And then it's the result of electrons that travel through a diffusive medium. And several of the partial waves interfere when they get together here. And the requirement to get that is that the elastic scattering length is much smaller than the sample size, and that is much smaller than the phase coherence and the phase coherence length. And when you do an experiment of this type, you will typically see fluctuations in the conductance as a function of some control parameter. Usually that's the magnetic field, which changes the phase of all these paths. And then if you look at the root mean square value of the fluctuations, you find this universal value of e square over h. What we are going to do is different in many respects, but I show you here a few examples of conductance fluctuations in a contact of roughly one atom of gold. You see, there are fluctuations which are not even that small, but they are definitely smaller than the universal value. That is also not surprising, because if we think that they are the result of this interference, then we have our contact here. The electrons travel into the banks, they get scattered at defects and come back here. But when they are a distance of the scattering length away, the probability to return to this small atomic size contact is very small. So we expect actually that the amplitude is reduced. Still, as you see, each time we make a new contact, it looks different, okay? But it's reproducible for a single contact. As you can see, these are all double traces, so it's been recorded twice. There is a second difference. In the previous cartoon that I showed you of the universal conductance fluctuations, the fluctuations are measured as a function of magnetic field. Here we don't do that. What we do, and you can't do that for a macroscopic or mesoscopic sample, is we apply a voltage difference. That's very nice, because you have the voltage concentrated on the contact itself, so you can accelerate the electrons at the contact, and then they get ballistically shot into this diffusive region, and with that you can change their energy and therefore their K vector. Okay, so otherwise the principle is the same. And what we measure here is the differential conductance. So we apply a certain bias voltage over the contact and make a little tickling less than 1 millivolt modulation voltage in order to measure the derivative of the current with voltage at that bias. What you see here is that there is a certain size, a certain amplitude of the, sorry, of the a certain amplitude of the fluctuations, but it appears that there is a smaller amplitude here in this range where the mean conductance is around 1. Okay, that is surprising, but it's just an example and there's fluctuation, so why would it be anything special? Clearly what we have to do is make an ensemble average. And in contrast to the usual mesoscopic studies, here we can really make an ensemble average. Okay, we can repeatedly make many contacts that have the same conductance and then look at what the fluctuations for these conductances are. However, in order to measure such curve as this takes half an hour, and then of course it's a long process to do all that. So what we did is slightly different. We take a large modulation amplitude given here by this bar, modulation amplitude of 20 millivolts at a frequency of 48 kilohertz, and then at a given bias voltage of zero, around zero, we monitor the conductance and the derivative of the conductance. So in this case, you would find something like a slope here, and here you would find a slope like this, and here you would find a slope like that. And we do that by simply using two lock-in amplifiers. One measures the modulation frequencies itself, and the other measures the second harmonic, which gives you the derivative immediately. Then we can measure a curve like this, where and in the bottom you see a trace like I showed you before for gold, which goes down in steps and then breaks here. And at the same time, we measure then the derivative of the conductance with voltage. And you see that each time there is a step in the conductance, there is a large step in the fluctuation, which you expect when there is a change of order of the Fermi wavelength in the composition of our conductor. You expect that the whole interference pattern changes. Even in this expanded scale, you can see that there is a little glitch here in the conductance, which is hardly visible, but it has a large effect on the conductance fluctuations. Or sorry, on the derivative, I should say here. Now, this whole curve can be measured now in 30 seconds, roughly. And then we can do many of these and collect all the data at a given conductance value. So we sort all the data as a function of conductance and determine the root mean square value of the derivative as a function of the conductance. And here I show the result of that. Now, this was very surprising when we found that, because we were thinking of conductance fluctuations as we have our contact, we have this interference path, and we have another path, and these two interfere, come back at the contact. And so what could the influence of the contact be on that interference pattern? But clearly, there is a great influence. We see a sharp minimum here at 1, and then there at 2 and 3 and 4, a very well-defined minima in the fluctuation amplitude. Okay. So we started looking for an explanation. And we discussed with several people. Nobody came up with a good suggestion. But we were helped to some extent by work that was done already a few years ago by Maslow and al., where they made a simulation of a two-dimensional electron gas point contact with defects around it. And they changed the defect configuration many times. And then they could see that each time that there was a step in the conductance, that the variation in the conductance due to the variations in the configuration of the defects produced a peak in the fluctuation. So that seemed to fit a little bit with what we were seeing, but they didn't offer an explanation. So we started thinking, and at a certain moment we realized that the crucial point is that we should regard our contact as a scatterer. Let me explain what I mean by that. If we think of an electron coming in a certain channel, like here, then when the contact is not perfect, there is a certain probability for a reflection at the contact and transmission, of course. The reflected wave can be reflected again in the diffusive medium around the contact and then be transmitted again through the contact. That would give you a partial wave that has the reflection amplitude, in the diffusive medium, and the transmission amplitude. And similarly, you can think of paths like this, plus the wave that is directly transmitted, and so you get interference between these various contributions. And now it's clear that when T is not, the transmission probability of the contact is not 1, then this is the most important scattering event, because all these scattering in the diffusive banks get reduced by this geometric return probability to the contact. So all these A's that I have here are small factors. So we only have to take these lowest order trajectories into account and then think of interference between these and that one. Okay. Now let's work that out. So we write the conductance for our experiment. We have a current as a function of voltage, bias voltage, and modulation voltage. And well, the bias voltage is 0, so that's simple. And then this one gives, so we make a series expansion, a Taylor expansion, and you see that the first term, which is proportional to the frequency, is the conductance. The second term, which is proportional to this double the frequency, is the derivative of the conductance, and that's the two parameters that we measure. So then we define this sigma GV as the root mean square value of the derivative, and we calculate the current in this way from the transmission matrix, and then, as I said, we have to take into account the interference terms with the reflection in the banks. And now comes the important step that makes it possible for us to calculate it. That is that we take the ensemble average of the reflection amplitude times conjugate of that. We take that to be given by the integral over all times of trajectories in the diffusive medium of a classical return probability, a classical probability for the electron to go into the bank and return into a single mode in the contact, times a phase factor, and that's the phase that the electrons acquire in their path of length t in the banks. Okay, so let me just show that. For the classical return probability, we have this expression where it's just the classical diffusion expression that we get here. And we take into account, but that's just in order to get a better analysis of the experiment, a certain opening angle of the contact here, gamma, which we take somewhere in the range of 45 degrees. Okay, so then when we put all this in, we do the integral. This is what we get out for the conductance fluctuation. Sorry, for the root mean square value of the derivative, which is due to this interference effect. And you see that it scales with 1 over the elastic scattering time to the power 3/4, and that scaled to this modulation amplitude that we have taken into account. Important is to see that it goes as the square root of t squared times 1 minus t. So indeed, it's expected to be 0 when t is 1. Okay. Now, what do we not know from this expression? We can make an estimate for this gamma. We do not know the scattering length in principle. We can take the bulk one, but we don't expect that to be relevant for the small contact. And we don't know the transmission probabilities. But let us make some assumption. And the curve that we've drawn here is that we've assumed that each time there is a single atom, a single channel opening at the time. Okay, so the first channel opens, and here it's fully open, then it stays open, and the next opens. And you see that with this simple assumption, we get already a reasonable description of our data, and then the amplitude fixes the scattering time. Okay, there is a very small deviation here, I would say, between zero and the actual amplitude, because if you think of how much of a admixture of a second channel you would need to explain this, it is only 0.5%. 0.005 of a second channel is needed in order to explain this value. So it really shows that for single atom contacts of gold, which is in this range of conductance, we have a single channel to a very good approximation. And then apparently we have a very good approximation of a second channel, but gradually this gets less accurate. Okay, we could try other assumptions, and this is just to show that it doesn't work. If you take in this range of one of 0 to 1, you take you assume that there are two channels which are randomly distributed, then this is what you would get. So it doesn't work at all. Now, if you do this experiment, you can, as I said, we have collected all the conductance values, so you can also collect all the conductance values themselves in a histogram, which is often done. And this is the histogram, which is for many people well known for gold. And you see that, well, clearly we have a large peak at 1, because we often find this plateau in the conductance at 1. Then there is a second and a third peak, and so on. What you will notice is that the minimum here coincides nicely with this peak, but the minimum here does not coincide at all with the peak here. Okay? What we learn from this is that you have to be very careful in interpreting conductance histograms, because conductance histograms tell you what is the most preferred value of the conductance, or which are the preferred values of the conductance, but that values of the conductance. But that can be determined not only by conductance quantization, but also by structure. And we think that this peak is simply due to having two atoms in the contact, which have a conductance around this value. Okay, so that gives a stable geometry, which you will then often find, but has nothing to do with the electronic structure. Okay. Then to show you, we have many examples, but I won't go through all of them, that it's very different if we go from an S metal, a simple monovalent metal like gold, to a more complicated metal like niobium, which is an SD metal, then what you show, what you see here in the conductance conductance histogram is that there is a single peak at about 2.2 or so, which is just showing you that on average a single atom contact of niobium has this conductance value, but you see there is quite a bit of spread. At the same time, you see that there is no structure at all to be discovered in the conductance fluctuations, which is just what we would expect, because for niobium we have five channels in a single atom which are partially open, and so there is no way to get into this situation where there is only a single channel perfectly transmitted. Okay. Now we have tested this expression that that I showed you for the fluctuations in two ways. One is we have a certain prediction for the dependence on the modulation amplitude, and that is certainly something that we can test. So we did four different amplitudes ranging over a factor of 8, and then scaled the measured fluctuations by this modulation amplitude to the power 3-4, and you see that it scales fairly well. At the end there is a little bit of deviation, but I would say, given the fact that there is a factor of 5 difference in V to the power 3-4, this is a very good agreement. Also, if you try to bring these data together and try to find the optimum power, then we find the power value which is very close to this 3-4. And then there is a second a test, and I have how much time do I have?
5 plus.
Okay, so I'll go quickly through that. And it's telling the history a bit in reverse, because really the experiment started with this. We started measuring the thermal power, but that is often how it works. We got data that we didn't understand, and when thinking about it, we realized that it's better to start doing conductance the conductance. But all right, in any case, we did the thermal power. And so in order to do thermal power with break junctions, you have to make a few modifications. What we did is the same principle you recognize here, the wire with the notch. But then on each side of the notch, we mounted a small a thermometer and a resistor as a heater. In this way, we can set up a temperature difference and measure the temperature difference over the contact, and then measure the induced voltage difference due to this applied temperature difference. Okay, that's the parameter that we want to study. Apply temperature difference, measure voltage, DC voltage. And then you can do the same thing roughly as we did with the conductance fluctuations. We measure the conductance, and you see the steps, and at the same time we record, but then we have to switch off, of course, the current by which we measure the conductance. So this is a slow process. We measure here conductance, switch off the current, and measure the voltage that we have just due to the temperature difference, and do that at every point. But you see that again, each time there is a jump in the conductance, there is a jump in the thermal power. And even again, small features here are recognized as rather large features here in the thermal power. Right, then, okay, we can go through the whole analysis again, because the thermal power can be expressed in similar terms, in terms of the transmission probabilities. And we did that, and this is the expression that we get. So this is the analogous expression for the thermal power that I showed you before for the conductance. And what you see is that there is this same dependence that we had before, but it's now divided by the total conductance. And instead of having the modulation voltage here, we have now the temperature. And there are a few constants in front which are different, but that's just standard. Okay. There is one parameter here which is C, which is a numerical factor that comes out of an integration. Which is only this value when the temperature difference compared to the absolute value of the temperature goes to zero. That is not the case in our experiment. We have to put a relatively large temperature difference of 5 to 10 kelvins, but C changes only slowly, so we can take that into account. It's only 5% change or so for the actual value. And when we do that, then we collect all our data together. This is what we see. So this is again a curve that you get when you assume that the channels open one by one, and you see again that in the beginning the agreement is fairly good, and later you would say it's not so good. Okay. But it's much more difficult to get good statistics. And then to convince you that we have indeed a good agreement here, what we can do is we can scale the results that we had before for the conductance fluctuations to the thermal power, because the two expressions are very similar. And so what I plot here is the amplitude of the conductance fluctuations divided by the conductance. That's the yellow points, and then we plot the thermal power, where we just take into account the difference in the prefactors compared to this one. And then you see that without any adjustable parameter, all these numbers are known. You can map the measured conductance fluctuations directly onto the thermal power result, and that shows not only that we've done our experiment correctly, But also that the description that we have is valid over a very large energy range, because the energy, the excitation energy that we use for the thermal power is relatively small compared to the one that we used for the conductance fluctuations. Okay, that brings me to the conclusions. I'm a bit early here. For atomic size contacts of monovalent metals, we observe a quantum suppression of the fluctuations close to multiples of the conductance quantum. And that is described in terms of scattering properties of the bare contact, so that tells us something about transmission probabilities of a contact of a single atom, and how, in the case of gold, we can come close to this ideal situation of having a single channel with nearly perfect transmission. Then we see something that was not anticipated from the, let's say, the calculations so far, is that for copper, silver, gold, sodium, the monovalent metals, but I've shown you only explicitly gold, there is what we call saturation of channel transmission. That is that tendency that even after the first contact, after the first atom, we still see that the conductance has a tendency to follow this process of opening a channel one by one. It's not perfect, but it is let's say for gold at two channels, the third channel is present to about, on average, to about 5%. Then at three channels, it's about 10%. Okay, so it's fairly well obeyed. Then we see that there are fluctuations in the thermal power, which have a similar origin as the conductance fluctuations, and that we can bring these two into quantitative agreement. Thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you very much. What is the role of interaction? I mean, in your analysis, you didn't take interaction effects into account for these monovalent metals.
That's right. Well, we haven't, because we can't. But in fact, I think there's a good reason in certainly for, let's say, the trajectories that the electrons take in the bulk. We can start from a Fermi liquid picture, and then we can forget about interactions. Okay. Now, whether you can neglect interactions also at the scale of the single atom, that is still a bit of an open question, as you well know. But my own impression is that it's still a very good approximation, because this atom is coupled very strongly to the banks. and the distance is only half an atomic distance, so it's smaller than the Thomas Fermi screening length. If there would be strong interaction effects locally on this one atom, you may expect to have, as you already suggested, condyle-like features. And we've never seen that so far, but maybe we should look better. No.
I think so that the important message is which actually was understood in the prehistoric days of conductance fluctuations is that the eigenvalues, the Tn that lead to fluctuations are only those that are not close to zero and not close to one, only those that are significantly different. That can because of your Tn squared times 1 minus Tn formulation. And this brings me to, I think the question which is hidden here is, if you say conductance of 2 Lisko over H, a lot of people will jump to the conclusion that you have 2 open channels and all the rest are closed, and that's not true.
Yes.
And I think the fluctuations and the thermopower are very good ways to see that, to sort of be sensitive to that issue, along with analysis such as was done by Saclay and Kasher and so on.
Still, thank you for that comment, Joe, but in our case, it's to me very clear why the fluctuations get suppressed when I have a T close to zero or close to one. I would have more difficulty seeing that in a simple image for a general mesoscopic system. But maybe the reasons are related, and so it would be useful to think about that. Yeah.
Maybe you answered this already, but do you have a feeling for why it is that in monovalent atoms you see almost perfect transmission, whereas in divalent and trivalent ones, you don't?
I can give you only a partial answer. One is that if you think of this atom sitting here between leads, and you have an S wave orbital that couples very nicely to the banks on both sides. But when we add to that a P wave orbital that may be weakly coupled, the overlap may be much less good. And if you look at the analysis for aluminium, that's indeed what you see, that there is an S-like orbital which is nearly, or which is largely transmitted, and there are P-like orbitals which give rise to channels that are only partially transmitted. But still, that's not the full answer, because if you look at the total conductance for a single atom of aluminium, which has 3 channels, as I told you, the total conductance comes out to be close to 1 with 3 channels. Okay, so it means that even the one that we expected to be nearly fully open is suppressed somehow, maybe due to the interaction with the other two. That is less clear. And with Wolfler and his colleague Hans Kroh have suggested that perhaps that is due to on-site correlations, which would be interesting, but okay, we have to think how to test that.
Can you test that with
fluctuation? No. The more direct signal would be that odd valent metals, so you would have an uneven number of electrons, you would expect in that case to have a condyle-like signal. And that is something we might look for.
Have you tried to implement the finite bias for modulating around the finite?
Yeah, we did a little bit, not very systematically. We've tried to zero and a finite value of about 20 or so. And there was not a great difference, except that there was a little bit of an indication that we might see, when you go where you have a perfect, you sit in the middle of a conductance plateau for a conductor, a quantum conductor, then you expect that there is little influence of the conductance of the transmission itself, right? Now we're talking about the bare transmission probabilities. But at the transition to the second plateau, you might expect it to be more sensitive. And this effect might come out if you go to finite bias. We've looked at that, but it's very small. If it's there, it's very small. It's we can hardly we couldn't make sure above the noise level. So. Yeah. There is one there. No, we don't see a great difference. I can show you the results for copper here, for instance. And, they look qualitatively the same. Even the mean free path comes out to be roughly the same. So, no. But then maybe we haven't looked for the right signatures. We haven't seen any difference.
Thank you very much again.
Thank you.